subcommittee meeting to order. Members present, Representative Demar, Representative Cotton, Representative Sun, Representative Springer, Representative Davidson. Also have staff from Representative Herman's office here who are going to be making a few comments this morning. We have before us House Bill 364, an act relating to fishing violations, providing for an effective date. At this meeting, what I'd like to do is just go through a general discussion on what we're attempting to do here. We've reached kind of a consensus that we need to pass something that will address the issue of commercial fishing violations and taking away some of the financial incentive to breaking the laws. At the same time, we have some serious questions with portions of this bill. With that, I'm going to open it up to committee discussion. We have in Anchorage, Lisa McCracken, and in Dillingham, Charles Mariner online from the AG's office. Bill, do you want to testify?
None of us have questions.
No, we're fine. Unless you have some questions.
Do you want to make some comments?
Yeah, just to try to get the discussion going, I guess that one of the complaints I've heard that came up was that under the proposed legislation, a maximum fine for a violation would be $6,000. And the complaint was that some of the hand troll permits in the southeast that was probably about the value of a hand troll permit, at least in that range. So it might seem inappropriate in those cases, whereas in other cases if you get a big purse center out in Jignik or something like that, I mean, it's probably not unusual to have a $6,000 set, so I'm not sure how you can arrange that to satisfy both situations, but I assume that the $6,000 is a maximum penalty, so I'm not particularly bothered by it myself.
$6,000 plus the fish, is that correct?
Well, I understand is it must forfeit the fish, may not forfeit best of the gear. Present law allows fish, vessel, and gear as discretionary. They could lose all three right now, as I understand it. Absolutely.
Okay. First, with respect to whether vessels are forfeited currently,
I need to have you state your name for the record also.
This is Liza McCracken with the Attorney General's Office in Anchorage. Currently, vessels are not forfeited under strict liability violations for commercial fishing violations, but the maximum fine right now for a strict liability offense is $300, and courts have forfeited fish. The second point I wanted to address was the fact that the bill does not take away the discretion that a judge has and always has had to be flexible in determining what a fine is appropriate for a particular violation. So if you had a very small fishery even a $300 or $500 fine was a large fine given that the economic situation of that particular fishery, the judge would still have the flexibility of doing that. And by the same token, in the case of the much larger fishery, the judge would still have the option of assessing a fine of up to $6,000. What to a large extent this bill is trying to do is to put us back to the same situation that existed from the time of statehood until these recent court decisions, where most fishing game, commercial violations were treated as strict liability offenses and did have a maximum fine of up to $5,000 in forfeiture a year. So what this does is it ups it to a maximum of $6,000, eliminates the forfeiture of gear because that's really not cost effective in a strict liability violation. And then also increases the criminal misdemeanor. So if you have a really large enterprise with a great deal of money involved and a serious violation, it would presumably then be charged as a misdemeanor.
Representative Cotton?
Yeah, Liza, I guess I misunderstood Larry Spangler when she was here last. I think she, in fact, we have a piece of paper here that she scratched out some of the penalties under current law and under what the bill proposes. She suggests that now fish vessels and gear are discretionary under a violation as far as what can be forfeited. So that's not the way you interpret the existing law?
Well, as a practical matter, and I perhaps ought to defer here again to Charles Mariner, the district attorney in Dillingham, because he's dealt with more of these cases, but it's my understanding as a practical matter, judges are not forfeiting vessels in connection with any strict liability offenses.
I'm asking you what the current law is, not the practice of the judges.
Well, the current law isn't really that specific as to whether you could or couldn't. It's a question of whether it would be permissible to forfeit a vessel and whether that would appear to be more of a criminal in nature kind of penalty. And in those court decisions where the judges have determined what amount of what could be forfeited under a strict liability offense, it's my understanding that these large vessels would not be forfeited. And again, perhaps Charles Mariner can give you somewhat better information on that.
This is Charles Mariner. This Constantine decision that came down this spring interpreted legislative intent and said that the legislature for the strict liability violation has only provided for a maximum of $300 and has not allowed any forfeitures in terms of a criminal penalty. They did say in Constantine, the Court of Appeals in a 2-1 decision, the majority decision, the two judges said that, of course, as to any illegally taken fish, you can have a forfeiture there. That's not a penalty as such. It's merely reclaiming for the people of the state that which was never legally put into possession of somebody else. So, in effect, for a strict liability violation now, the Constantine decision has read your intent as meaning only a maximum $300 fine, and that's it. You can't forfeit anything else in terms of a penalty for that. Would you agree with that, Liza?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah.
Thank you. I'd also like to note for the record that in your packets there's a letter from law firm of Robinson, Beiswanger, and Earhart, Chuck Robinson, and an attorney on the Kenai Peninsula who is also familiar and quite involved with commercial fishing and court challenges.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cotton.
The other question here, and this is kind of just bouncing around, I know, but Larry Spangler has a note at the bottom of the page she gave us. It says that The bill would establish a rebuttable presumption that fish taken at, fish at the site were taken illegally. And I guess I would like to have somebody just maybe explain some circumstances that might occur under, you know, with, that might apply to. I can imagine that if you're fishing before the allowed time, you've got a stack of fish in your boat, I guess that's one situation where people could presume that you've taken those fish illegally. I'm not sure about other circumstances where you might have been holding fish for a longer period of time, or you may have caught some fish on the correct side of the line and some fish on the incorrect side. I'm not sure how that all would get worked out.
Charles, you're probably more familiar with some of those examples. Maybe that's one you ought to pick up on.
Okay, this is Charles Mariner. With presumptions in the law, you generally look to, when you're dealing with, in effect, a civil situation like this. In other words, here are a bunch of fish, and the state's saying that these fish are belonging to the people of the state. The fisherman is saying, no, I caught them legally. Generally speaking, with presumptions, you throw the onus of proof onto the party that is better able to show what happened. Well, my experience out here in Bristol Bay is that we are usually in a very poor position of in any way showing that the fish were illegally taken. Now, in the one example given there by one of you, if you catch somebody 10 minutes early and the last period was 2 days earlier, then there, I guess, would be really no problem in the fact finder determining, regardless of who has the burden of proof, as to those fish being illegally caught. But the in my area, at least, 90% of the cases are not fishing early cases, but rather fishing over the line and fishing late. So in those cases, the trooper comes aboard. He's usually running hither and thither, trying to sight three or four different people at the same time. He orders the net to be brought up. There is a hold of fish on board anyway. And so when I have my trooper then in front of the judge, he really can't say, well, I know that 396 fish came aboard on that last illegal set, because he doesn't have the time to stay around. And of course, it's quite easy for the fishermen then to fabricate too, I guess, in that we can't prove him wrong. But at least this would put the burden on him to establish that, well, only 33 fish came aboard on that last set. And it is simply preponderance. All he has to do is prove more likely than not to a 51% proof. In other words, that's all he has to show through a preponderance, that the fish that he wants to keep were actually brought in legally.
This is Leslie McCracken in Anchorage. I think one thing to keep in mind, as Charles pointed out, is that as with most presumptions, the purpose of it is to place the burden on the person who has the most knowledge about the situation. And in this case, it's going to be the fisherman who is in the best position to be able to present evidence as to whether those fish were taken appropriately or legally.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, this is Representative R, I'm just wondering how the fisherman's going to prove that.
This is Charles Mariner again. Actually, in the situations I've had out here when we've tried to sort out which were the illegally caught fish, the real question becomes, how in the world can we overcome the assertions made by the fishermen that they were legally caught, especially if we have the burden. they don't have to come forward and say anything. Our trooper gets on the stand and he'll say, gee, I didn't count those fish that came in. I can maybe estimate that I saw so many brought aboard, but in effect, we aren't in a position of establishing anything when it comes right down to it. The way it works out here with the limited manpower they've got when they sight somebody. And so the fisherman will say, with his crew members, if he wants to bring them forth as well, he'll say that we had so many on board, and I mean, we don't have to get down to the exact number of fish. The fact finder can sort it out if we talk in broad terms of, well, that last net that came in, of course, the fisherman himself, if he gets nabbed, he could certainly make a very careful count when he has his crew members bring that in. But all he has to do then is say, we counted, or we already had roughly 4,000 fish on board. It's just a matter of him establishing what he already had on board as versus what came in on that bad set.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Representative Sund. I have just a simple technical question. If the fish are forfeited to the state, what do you do with them?
This is Charles Mariner again. We, in Bristol Bay at least, when we have a citation, we'll board the boat and direct the boat, usually board the boat. Sometimes we don't have the manpower to actually keep somebody aboard, but we'll direct the boat over to a tender, and the whole process will take probably 2.5-3 hours as a general rule, and then we'll just simply sell those fish there, and the tender writes the check out to the state of Alaska rather than to the fisherman. We then have the check in our possession and turn it in to the judge. Judge puts it into a trust account until the case is decided. If we lose the case or fish and aren't in effect forfeited, the money is then paid back to the fisherman.
Just a simple question. Does the state have a limited entry permit to sell those fish under?
You know, I've never even had that question come up. Of course, we don't know, but the tenders simply write the check stuff for us. Maybe we're breaking the law. I hadn't even thought of that one.
Well, I'm a fish processor, and it's against the law for any processor to buy any fish from anybody without a limited entry permit. So I'm just...
I haven't charged any of those tenders for writing this out to my troopers, or neither have I charged any of the troopers, but that's an intriguing point.
Well, it's come up in Southeast, I can guarantee you that. So
I haven't even heard of that.
Yeah, well, perhaps the Department of Law might want to evaluate whether or not they want to add something in the bill that would clear that point up. I had a question on 05722, the penalties. You're not allowed to have a jury trial, and all the state has to do is come up with a preponderance of the evidence. What happens next? Now, what if I don't like the way that comes out? Now, where's my appeal from this penalty that's been imposed on me for strict liability?
Well, we've got to be on the list for that.
This is Charlie Mariner. Yeah, I guess I could answer that on what happens after the trial. In this case, it came down 3 years ago for Rand that them up. That's the way they interpreted what you all had done. And they ruled that for strict liability offenses in the commercial fishery area, that you all didn't want what were penalties up in the criminal range, and the court then, I guess, well, they did rule that for the non-criminal violation, they left it unclear as to what the maximum penalties could be, and they eventually decided that in constant as to what you all think on what the penalties should be, at least as of now. They also said that for these non-criminal violations, that there is no right to a jury trial because you're not being charged with a criminal offense, and there's no right to public counsel for the same reason. So then you have a judge sit, and the judge is the fact finder. If you lose, then you have the same appellate process as with any other case. You appeal it up, and you have a right to appeal. You get your choice of form. You can either go to a superior court judge and say, I got a thumb deal down below, or you go to the Court of Appeals. Now, so far the Court of Appeals has taken these quote civil violation cases as we see with Constantine. They are a criminal appellate court. So far they have considered themselves as having jurisdiction, so I assume that's the route you would go, and that's the way they have been going. They've been going either to a superior court judge or to the Court of Appeals. So you can appeal on the basis of error occurring below. It's just that you can't say that I should have had a jury trial, or at least so far the Court of Appeals has said you have no right to a jury trial, you have no right to public counsel, but the trial has to be fair in all respects that you're given right concerning. I don't know if that really answers the question.
Yeah, that answers it. I can go to the Superior Court or Court of Appeals. And finally, I guess I'm just curious about, I'm looking at page 2, this is 722C, and this may be a standard proving a case here for a violation when you say by preponderance of the evidence. I know that's a lesser standard than beyond a reasonable doubt, and I ask now, is that standard for the requirement of the state for conviction of a violation?
This is Charles Mariner. In the civil area, that is the general standard of proof. But, and I'm not positive on this, as I really don't get involved in much in traffic tickets. For example, the other types of violations we have in Title 11 are generally the minor traffic offenses. And I can't tell you for sure, but I think the standard there is still beyond reasonable doubt, that the legislature's never said otherwise. And it would have to be beyond reasonable doubt if we were dealing with a criminal offense, but in that we're dealing with a civil penalty, it would be constitutional to make it preponderance of the evidence. And the bill asked for that. In my experience out here, it's awfully easy to come up with a good, legitimate excuse, I guess, or it's not that, it's a hard area to prove guilt in, this area of fish enforcement. And traditionally around the country, the reason historically fishing game laws around the country have been treated as strict liability offenses is because of the difficulty of proof. That's been one great impetus for having strict liability in this fish and game area. It's just hard to prove in this area. And, I mean, we could live with beyond a reasonable doubt. We have been, in effect. It hasn't been preponderance of the evidence. This would be a definite change in the law now. But constitutionally, it would be authorized, and so the legislature, you all will just have to decide whether you want to make it easier for the state to get convictions in the area. And our argument would be that it is that easy, that there are good excuses that are pretty easily put forth by the fishermen. It's incredible what can come up. And we're not in a position of really countering. We haven't been aboard, for example.
This lies in the crack in Anchorage. I just wanted to point out one area where we already have a well-established use of preponderance of the evidence standard in a commercial fisheries area, and that's in civil forfeiture actions, where the state files it's called an in rem action against a vessel, which we do usually in major commercial fishing violations and large crab vessels and so on, for serious violations. We bring a civil action against the vessel itself, not against the skipper or any individual, but against the vessel itself, and seek forfeiture of that vessel. And in those cases, it's been clearly set out in by the Alaska Supreme Court that the appropriate standard of proof in those cases is preponderance of the evidence. The FV American Eagle was a case that discussed this in some detail and approved that standard proof, so that preponderance of the evidence isn't in a commercial fishing context is not an unprecedented standard.
I wanted to ask about the simple negligence as compared to gross negligence for the misdemeanor violation.
This is Charles Merriman. Maybe I can somewhat answer that. We have in Title 11 different mental states set out, four of them: intentional, reckless, intentional, reckless, negligence. Well, let's see. I don't know why I can't think of that fourth one. But anyway, the bottom one is criminal negligence. And for example, if we charge somebody with criminally negligent homicide, we have to show a gross deviation from the standard of care people ordinarily have. Well, that's in the area we're in. We're giving people many years of jail as a max sentence. And we've had a couple of Alaska Supreme Court opinions that talk of what the standard should be or is in the area of commercial fishing violations. And we haven't had a definitive ruling yet in the sense they have said this is the way it would be okay to have it read. One, the earlier case I remember is a case called Rice, probably the one that would be best to look at in terms of what the Alaska Supreme Court is thinking. But after analyzing it, we came up with this particular definition, and we believe that the Alaska Supreme Court, in effect, has already said that this civil negligence, the negligence is generally used when you're dealing in tort law, when you have an automobile accident, you have to decide which one was negligent. This is the standard that the jurors are given. And so, in that we're dealing with in effect, fine in your proposed bill. If we had a higher standard, again, arguing back on how difficult it is in this area of fish enforcement to prove violations, offenses, if we had a higher standard, we wouldn't get many convictions. And I can just tell you, come out here this spring, I've had several trials in which I have tried to get misdemeanor conviction because a $300 limit is virtually meaningless, and I can't, in effect, I might as well give up as just try them as violators rather than misdemeanors. And of all the cases I've tried this summer, trying to get a conviction, and that's even using this standard, I've got judges, even without legislation, hearkening back to the Rice test, I've had judges always give this just simple negligence instruction. I have yet to have a jury convict of misdemeanor. They've always come in, every one of them came in with the lesser included offense, the violation. So even with this particular standard, it's not going to be at all easy to get a conviction. If we had a gross negligence standard, it would be, I would venture to say, virtually impossible would be a fair statement.
And how would that be changed by perhaps more money at the enforcement end?
Well, we've put on a big push in Bristol Bay the last 3 years. I mean, a very big push. We've got down here, as I remember, probably 40% of fish cops in the whole state. Just here for this month's time, and it's still a big area, and there are a lot of boats. I mean, hundreds of boats will be fighting over just a real small area to fish these lines. I'm sure some of you know the Bristol Bay fishery to some extent, and I can't see that realistically speaking, a greater effort at enforcement would, in the individual case, make it to wherein we would be able to prove gross negligence. It's just, fishermen aren't crooks to begin with. I mean, they're nice people. And when we have jurors who are predominantly fishermen anyway in this area, sit in judgment, it's just hard to come up with some idea that a fellow is grossly negligent. It's even hard to come up with the idea that he was negligent if you've got the out given to you of convicting of strict liability, which is what the situation is now. We've got the two-tier system, which is one bad effect of having the two-tier system. We just had the one possibility. If we would try the cases just as negligent cases, they wouldn't have the option of demanding the lesser-included offense instruction of strict liability. Then my experience is they would convict them of the higher offense, but if given the chance to go lower, they will. So it would be, I don't think, the answer to have heightened enforcement. I don't think that would be able to give it to us.
Okay, well, I would agree with you that fishermen are not criminals, but my concern is that we're going to be making them criminals by a test of simple negligence rather than gross negligence.
Charles Merrigan for years, of course, it's been strict liability. Just a little background maybe on Moran. Before Moran, we had a case called Brennell, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Brennell was the first of these cases that dealt with whether or not we have to prove negligence or whether it is strict liability. The Court of Appeals came down in Brennell and said, we think the Board of Fisheries wants negligence as a standard and has not given strict liability as a possibility. Within 5 or 6 months, the Board of Fisheries came back after Reynolds and said, no, we want strict liability for everything. Well, then there was was back in the lap with the Court of Appeals, and then the Court of Appeals came down in Buran and said, well, maybe the Board of Fisheries wants strict liability, but the legislature hasn't given the Board of Fisheries the option of doing that. The legislature has said, this is the way they interpreted your legislation, the legislature has said that before you can have any jail time, you must prove negligence. Strict liability, you can't go to jail. And that's the situation we had for the last 3 years. Then Constantine came down and said, well, the legislature not only has said that, but they've also said that if it is strict liability, it's only a $300 maximum. So that's the stage we're in now. So actually, historically, and around the country, for fish and game offenses, it is strict liability. So this jumping up to negligence is the unusual act. It's not, it's to go to gross negligence, I would say you couldn't find a jurisdiction in the country that would have anything in the nature of a gross negligence being required in the fish and game area.
We'll look into that. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Sam Cotton again. I'm looking now at the misdemeanor section, and I understand that you can get up to a $15,000 fine, you can have your gear taken, you must have the fish taken, and if you're guilty of any one of the four listed crimes the judge shall also impose a fine equal to the gross value of the fish on board. So I'm trying to think about what kind of possibilities we're looking at there. If you're looking at a limit seiner that's full of red salmon, you know, that's say even 50,000 pounds of fish, that could be what, $75,000 plus $15,000 plus gear in the vessel. I mean, you could be approaching $300,000-$400,000 there probably under some circumstances. Maybe I'm not sure exactly how that compares with what the situation is right now. Anybody want to comment on that?
The law now reads, being 5720C, that if you're convicted of one of those major commercial fishing violations, then you are subject to a fine of not less than the value of the fish on board. So that now is the law. And then if you're convicted, what is it, the third time, then it's equal to a minimum fine of three times the value of the fish on board. And yes, that can get into big money. I up here haven't had a third time offender. I don't know around the state if it's really come up. But it may be that you'll decide those minimum, that is a mandatory minimum fine. Yeah, it could be too much in the way of a penalty. That would have to be your call on that. But in effect, it's the present language of 720C in terms of the value of the fish on board. I don't think we're asked for any change there, other than I believe the $10,000 minimum on a third timer is added. In other words, if a fellow is caught as a third timer and he has only $300 worth of fish on board, 720, well, the replacement for 27C under this bill would at least hit him for $10,000, whereas before he would only have a $900 minimum fine under that section.
That's a, is that the...
It may be unconscionable for you all to find a stinger with $50,000 worth of fish on board, and he's only caught a very few illegally. It may not be right to hit him with a minimum. In other words, the judge under this proposal wouldn't have an option. He would have to give him three times the value, but then you may decide, well, if he's a third timer, he needs to suffer that kind of a minimum. We've got to have that kind of a deterrent in the plate. If we have people out there committing that many offenses, they've got to be extra careful. But in effect, it tracks present law. The real difference is the jump from 5,000 to 15,000. And that, of course, isn't a minimum. That's a maximum, and the judge can give zero if he wants.
Right.
One other point, this is Liza McCracken, on that subject is...
Yeah, this one here is a little bit...
$5,000 maximum misdemeanor fine was a carryover from the fine originally established in 1924. So the dollar amount today, in terms of the value of $5,000, is quite different, and increasing it to 15,000 is an effort to at least take into account the inflation and other economic changes, and to find an amount that's more realistic in terms of the value of some of these fisheries.
This is Charles Mayer. This is a fine point maybe you all should be aware of, and that is this on this section C. As the legislation is now written, it speaks in terms of shall be fined, what is it? I forget the exact language, but it's not shall be fined a value equal, a fine equal the value on board. It says there's a mandatory fine of not less than, those are the words, not less than the value of the fish on board, and the judges have been reading that, and actually the Department of Law's position is that is a correct interpretation, that the judge has an option. He can say under that section, okay, I'm going to take all the fish on board, find you that equivalent, but he also can say, going to do a zero fine under that section. But I can't go in between. I can't take half your fish. It's sort of a ridiculous interpretation of the statute, but that's what it seems to be. But the way it's...
He just got disconnected.
We got it pretty good.
Yeah. When they come back on...
Liza, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
Charles, are you still online?
Okay, this is Representative Navarre. We've got to quit the resources committee. Starts at 8:30, so we've got to vacate the committee room. We'll let you know when we're gonna have another meeting on this bill, Liza, and we'll also get in touch with Charles. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great name for a lawyer that does this kind of work, right?